Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. We're going to begin the program today by talking about something called Project Ice Cube. And don't let the name Ice Cube fool you. It's not a little inexpensive project, and it has a lot of science connected with it. It's a $270 million international effort. More than 20 collaborators are working with faculty and researchers here at the University of Wisconsin on this project. And it has to do with capturing neutrinos at the South Pole. With me in the studio today, Robert Paulus, who is UW-Madison a researcher, engineer, and project manager of Ice Cube. And with me by telephone, our second guest, Cale Hansen, an Ice Cube scientist visiting the South Pole, was collecting data there, and is joining us from the South Pole as well. Obviously, there are lots of great questions to ask here. I have a lot of them. I bet you have some questions, too, as we move along today, and you're most welcome to join in. Here's the number to call if you'd like to join us, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Bob Paulus, welcome. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, thanks, Larry.
And Cale Hansen, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Larry. Hi, Bob. I'm down here at the South Pole. Hope you guys can hear me pretty well.
Well, you're coming in loud and clear. I'm told that sometimes the atmosphere or whatever creates some problems when you're trying to talk by from the South Pole to Wisconsin. But it's a couple of cold places. Go ahead.
You can never be too sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll do our best here. And you just arrived, did you not?
Yeah, I came in about 18 hours ago. I was supposed to be here about 3 days ago, but one of the things, I mean, it's still kind of a remote place, and it's a long journey. I actually left Wisconsin over a week ago, and you're kind of at the mercy of the weather. So we had some bad weather on my way in, and my flight got scrubbed, so I'm about 3 days late.
Well, we have some cool temperatures here in Wisconsin, and actually, we would call it cold, I think. What about where you're at in Antarctica?
Well, I'm looking at the weather scroll right now, and I haven't been outside today. I came in yesterday, and it was about minus 20 degrees C, which is, I guess that's maybe minus 15 or minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Right now it's minus 28 C, which is about minus 15 Fahrenheit. So it's pretty cold here.
Yeah, it's got to be. Well, Bob Paulus, tell us a little bit about this project. Why are we digging a bunch of holes a mile deep in the ice?
What we're looking for are these very elusive subatomic particles called neutrinos, and I'll let Cale comment on the physics of this project in a minute. But in order to capture neutrinos, in order to capture their signature, we need to instrument a very large volume of something like ice or water. And it turns out that the ice at the South Pole is just ideal for this project. There's an ice sheet there that's about 3,000 meters thick, and so we bury our sensors, our what we call optical modules, in the ice up to a mile and a half deep in that sheet of ice. And we drill holes and drop instrumentation into holes that are about 2 feet across and, like I said, a mile and a half deep.
That's a long way down.
It is a long way down, and a big part of this project, and we put a great deal of engineering effort into the design and building and maintaining the drill that allows us to actually put this instrumentation into the ice.
Well, Cale Hansen, maybe you could talk a little bit more about neutrinos for those who aren't familiar. What are neutrinos, and why the heck do we want to study them?
Yeah, okay. So a neutrino is a subatomic particle. They've been known for, they've been hypothesized for almost 100 years, but have actually been observed for just about as long. What Ice Cube is doing, what the scientists on Ice Cube are actually looking for, is we're looking for neutrinos that are coming from basically from very far away in the universe. The real gold mine would be to catch things that are coming from high-energy extragalactic sources, such as black holes or other high-energy phenomena, way out there in the deep space. And the reason that we are using neutrinos, it's called neutrino astronomy. It's astronomy in the sense of with conventional astronomy, you use light particles, and the light particles come at you, and you receive them in your telescopes. And you can look on the sky and you can see little hot spots. That's kind of what we're doing with IceCube. We're basically just replacing the light particles with neutrinos, which have some other good properties. I mean, we can actually penetrate deeper into these high-energy sources with neutrinos than we can with light particles. And we kind of hope to do the same thing, look on the sky and map out hot spots and study those hot spots.
Mm-hmm. And what's the sort of the practical outcome of this for the average person sitting like me, sitting in my couch at home, wondering what practical value is it going to be? And maybe you could, Bob Paulus, you could start by talking about that a little bit.
Well, there are many ways to answer that question. I mean, there's some very practical aspects of the project from the point of view of it's a basic research project. We're the lead institution here, and so it brings a lot of engineering and scientific talent to the university, and that in itself is of a great benefit to, say, Madison and mm-hmm. the state of Wisconsin. Then there's the research aspect of it, and what might come out of this research. This is a basic research project. And then there's the very specific science goals of the project, which I'll let Cale comment on here.
Yeah, Cale, you want to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so as Bob mentioned, I mean, this is kind of basic research. I mean, it's astronomy in the sense of, as far as a tangible result to somebody, to you sitting on your couch at home, I can't really address that. But, we're looking for... basically looking to understand our universe. And, this is, me personally, and I know a lot of people, I mean, this is interesting stuff. I mean, we want to understand what's out there and what's going on in our universe. I think this is kind of one of the fundamental things about being human is to try and understand what's going on around us.
Mm-hmm.
And our specific science goals, as I said, are to try and understand what's at the high energy, in the very, very high energy regimes. And we're talking about energies where single particles, single neutrinos, are possessing macroscopic energies. This is actually pretty high, higher than energies that are produced in accelerators or anything on the Earth. And studying these sources, understanding what the physics are of black holes and other highly energetic phenomena that are raging out there in the deep universe.
Yeah. Talking today with Robert Paulus and Cale Hansen. Cale is actually at the South Pole right now, talking with us by phone. Bob Paulus with me in the studio as we visit with them about the IceCube project, capturing neutrinos at the South Pole. Questions? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Cale, maybe you could talk about what you're doing, what your role is down there.
Right now I came down for a couple of things. I'm kind of the IceCube, the project representative at the South Pole Station right now. So maybe that's my day job. My night job is I'm the leader of the data acquisition system. So as you can imagine, this is a huge detector. Right now we've got had a very good season and put in 13 new holes to the detector, added 13 new holes, and about, I haven't actually run the tally of the numbers, but it's probably on the order of 1,000 of these digital sensors that Bob was talking about. And so as you can imagine, with now we're going to have, we have over 1,000 because we actually had 600 that were in from the previous year's deployments. There's each of these guys produces a lot of data, and you've got to be able to pick through that data, sort through it, and kind of weed the interesting stuff out, which is you know, a fairly a small portion of the data that's pouring in is actually interesting stuff. You have to take this and do what's called trigger on it, so you trigger for interesting events. And this is all handled, of course, by a very large computer system that's sitting on the surface. And so I'm down here with a couple of other people, scientists and engineers, writing the software codes that help us understand this to actually get the data out of the ice and move it around and do all the triggering and look for the interesting physics.
And now, how many holes are you going to be dug eventually?
It's on the order of 70. So right now we've got the first year, 2 years ago, we deployed one hole. Last year we got 8, and this year we have 13. So I think that 22. So we're approximately, if you use holes as a metric for figuring out how far along you are, we're almost a third of the way, to completing the detector.
Bob Paulus, how the heck do you drill a hole a mile and a half deep?
Well, we use something that everybody's pretty familiar with. You melt the hole, and you melt that hole using hot water. Now, having said that, it's a pretty big operation, as you might imagine, since the holes are a mile and a half deep, and we have to drill these quickly and efficiently. And so we drill each hole in less than 3 days' time. And in order to do that, we have built this enormous hot water drill, which is comprised of over 1 million pounds of equipment that has all been flown down to the pole. Mm. Everything that gets to the south pole is flown in on a LC-130. So by the New York Air Guard, it turns out. And so all of our entire drill system was designed around the constraint that it had to fit inside a plane. We have an enormous hose reel, kind of like your backyard hose reel, only on the scale of, say, 8 feet. It's an 8-foot diameter drum. It's 20 feet long. And we wrap a couple of miles of hose on this hose reel. So that's just one of the big components that make up this enormous hot water drill. We have containers. We have about 15 containers that are 8 foot on a side and about 30 feet long that house all of the equipment that's used to heat water. So we melt snow and heat water to just a little below the boiling point. So it's about 190 degrees F. And we pressurize it to almost 1,000 PSI. And so we have a nozzle on the end of this hose, and we use gravity to point our way down, and we melt our way down a mile and a half deep.
I went on the website and saw, I believe there was a picture of one of the holes. It looks pretty darn precise.
Well, like I said, you know, the precision is all due to gravity. I mean, that part's pretty simple. We have about a 500-pound weight stack that, combined with the drill head and the nozzle on the end of that weight stack, is just finds its way right down to the bottom of the hole. It is, so now having said all this, we have all this heavy equipment. It's quite impressive when you're down there. It really kind of is something that really sticks out on the landscape, which is otherwise kind of flat and white. However, it's a very sophisticated tool. It's all computer controlled. This is a closed loop system. We pump water back up out of the hole. We monitor something like 340 input and output sensors in the system. And the person who actually pilots the drill sits at a computer screen. So it is, yet on the one hand, it's simple and kind of a dumb thing, but on the other hand, it's also very sophisticated from kind of an engineering and scientific point of view.
Talking about how we are capturing neutrinos at the South Pole with our two guests from the University of Wisconsin, Bob Paulus and Cale Hansen. Give us a call if you have a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about Project Ice Cube today with our two guests, Bob Paulus, a UW-Madison engineer, project manager of Ice Cube, and with us as well by way of telephone at the South Pole, Cale Hansen, scientist who will be collecting data, heading up some research that's going on down there right now, and certainly you can join in with your own questions or comments for them as we move along today. Lots of callers online, and I'd like to get some input from them. So let's go to the phones. And first to Dan in Madison. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Sure. I'm very interested in this. My son is there at South Pole right now working. He's worked with Bob before. And the article in the State Journal recently showed a picture of the drill that you were just describing. My question is when it melts down into the hole, into the ice, where does all that water go?
Well, it turns out that we want water in that hole. That's important. So we actually have to supply makeup water because as you melt ice, as you know, then there's a phase change. And so we actually supply a little additional water into the hole as we drill. And the idea here is that when we drop our instrumentation into a new hole, we want it filled with water. And then it will freeze back over the course of a couple of weeks' time or so.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I was asking, my son Mike is there, and he tells me that they ration water for showers and in laundry.
You got to save it for the holes.
Well, it turns out that, yeah, so that it's true. When you're at the pole, staying in the facility the National Science Foundation maintains there, you only get to shower a couple of times a week. So that makes for an interesting time. However, it turns out that the system that we have built is totally independent of the facility supplies. Oh. So we have a separate hot water system from the shower system. Although a lot of people have made comments like they'd like to tap into our system from time to time so they can get a more frequent shower.
Well, I don't think they sweat a lot.
No.
Well, Antarctica, isn't it about the driest? Well, it is the driest continent on Earth, is it not?
It is. And, you know, they don't. It's probably a common misconception that you get a lot of snowfall in the Antarctic or at least at the South Pole, but that's actually not true. I think the average snowfall amount is somewhere in the neighborhood of only a couple of inches or so. What's a bigger problem, it turns out, is blowing snow. Mm. But it is very dry, so in fact, yes, perspiration is not an issue, which we're concerned with, right? And then It also it feels different. When it's cold there, a similar cold here in say Madison feels a bit worse just simply because of the humidity in the air.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Another thing, maybe I could. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, go ahead.
A little bit of delay here, but another thing I wanted to add is that in addition to the extreme cold and the extreme dryness, it really is dry, which is, as Bob says, it's both good and bad in some respects. It's also you're at elevation. We're at about 10,000 feet, and so this is one of the things that I'm going through right now. Is it takes a couple of days, and everybody has a different experience, but it takes a couple of days to really become acclimated to the elevation and the cold and the dryness, and they all kind of gang up to make your first couple of days interesting.
Well, Dan, is your son enjoying his time down there?
Well, this is his second trip down. He went with Bob last year, and that's all he talks about until he goes again. I had another question about the dom. You know, Bob, the picture in the State Journal showed you with one of those doms, the ball that you deploy down into the shaft, and the plastic was off of it, and it just had that board there. How much cold can that thing withstand to be accurate?
Well, it's designed to withstand temperatures of, as a minimum, minus 55 C. So that's kind of a basic design criteria.
Mm-hmm.
They can probably withstand something quite a bit colder than that, though, actually, and still operate maybe minus 70 or so. I'm talking in degrees C now. And I won't convert because I'll probably make a silly math error. But, so that's the basic design criteria for temperature for those digital optical modules.
And for just those who might be just tuning in, there are 70 or so, or 70 to 80 holes that will be eventually dug. And down each one of these holes, there will be 80 cables, or one cable for each hole, and each cable will have about 60 of these glass globes that Dan was talking about. And what are they, about size of a volleyball or something?
A little bigger than that. Maybe closer to a basketball size.
A bit more like a basketball.
Right. So I'll let Cale comment in a minute on this, but the basic detecting element, the basic sensor element, is a thing called a photomultiplier tube, which sounds pretty fancy, but in very simple terms, it's kind of a light bulb in reverse. That's how we describe it. So what we're the signal that we detect is actually a flash of light, and that flash of light then is detected by our photomultiplier tube that is then it turns out that the signal then that we're interested in is converted into current.
Okay.
And then that signal is amplified and then sent to the surface and then ultimately to the northern hemisphere. So when I say it's a light bulb in reverse, instead of putting current in, you're taking current out.
Taking current out.
Yeah, so.
Cale, you want to comment?
Yeah, it's exactly like Bob said, and actually the photomultiplier tube is it's kind of old technology. These things have been around since World War II, so it's not nothing really new there. But they're still kind of, as it turns out, if you want to be able to detect a single particle of light, and that's really what our business is. The particles that we're looking for. You see, what happens is when a neutrino passes through the ice, we're looking for events where the neutrino actually bangs into some nuclear material, an ice molecule, oxygen or hydrogen, and some of these interactions will actually produce other particles, which are called muons or electrons. And these particles actually zip through the ice, and they're going at the speed of light, but it's actually faster than the speed of light in the medium. And so what that does is it creates kind of like a little it's the analog of a sonic boom. Produces a wavefront, and we actually have these sensors are, it's basically a big eye. It's a 10-inch diameter eye that can pick up the, one or two photon light particles that dribble in from these tracks, which can be meters or tens of meters distant from any given sensor module.
Interesting.
And it's exactly as Bob says. Then it becomes digitized. Each of the DOMs, they're called digital. They're called DOMs because the D is digital. It's a that's new technology, and that's actually fairly advanced. There's actually a computer, a pretty sophisticated computer inside each of these basketball-sized modules that are operating down in the ice. And those computers share information. They basically pump information up to the surface where, as I said earlier, it's all collected and sorted through.
Cool. Dan, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. I want to give some others a chance to join in. John and Paoli, we'll go to you next. John, hi, good morning.
Hi, great information and good discussion.
Thank you.
You were just touching on my interest in the collision aspect of these neutrinos going through and hitting, particles within the ice molecules or atoms there. And I'm wondering, isn't that basically what the super colliders do? And could you then observe or collect data on smaller subatomic particles created by the collision.
Cale Hansen?
So I'll try and field that one. You're right. It's exactly the same, the same kind of idea. At the super colliders, what they do is they, a collider has two beams, and you take one beam and collide it into another beam going the other way. And in that way, you can actually get energies that are much higher than what's called the center of mass. You basically have to transform all of your physics into what's called the center of mass system, because that's where it actually counts. We don't do that, but the other thing about colliders is that they have they know exactly where the interaction happens. We don't really have that much control. So whereas a collider can have a very dense amount of instrumentation, I mean, the collider experiments are incredibly complicated, and actually some of them are quite huge, the size of large buildings now, especially for the new collider facility in Europe. So they can have a lot of instrumentation in a dense area and really, with a fine detail, pick out what the particle interactions are and study each individual track. We don't have quite so much resolution. We're basically, as Bob said at the beginning of the program, we're looking for volume. And that's because the neutrino, when it bangs into these nuclei, there's a very, very small chance of this actually happening. The thing is called cross-section, and the cross-section is very, very small. So what we have to do is we have to hike up our volumes to this kilometer cubed. That's where all of the theorists say that the interesting physics starts happening, when you have about a cubic kilometer of detecting volume. But as kind of a result, you can't instrument your volume that densely. What our string spacings, the distance between our modules, is each module on the string is about 17 meters apart, and each string is about 125 meters apart. So these things are very, very sparsely instrumenting the ice. Nevertheless, we still have a pretty good handle because we know exactly what the physics is of these particles and the wavefronts that the particles give off in the ice. We can actually track the particles, and so we can do what's called track reconstruction, and we can, within about a degree, figure out exactly where these neutrinos are coming from, and that allows us to, as I said earlier, go back to the sky, and every time we get one of these particles, we can put a little push pin on the sky and keep accumulating this data and make a sky map or look for hotspots where a bunch of these push pins have accumulated over the years. Yeah, but it cool. can really take years.
Can I ask one more quick question?
Sure.
So with that instrumentation, are you then able to observe all of the collisions that occur or eventually will be able to in that square kilometer or cubic kilometer, or are you still missing a lot of information?
That kind of depends on how much energy you have. So there's a point in the energy of the primary particle coming in, which is around in units that physicists like to use, which are EV or GeV. So at around 100 GeV or 100 billion electron volts, any particle that's going to come in, that's going to interact, any neutrino that's going to interact inside the volume that's defined interior to the instrumentation that we put in there, has a pretty good chance of being detected by the detector. Below, as the energy goes down, you start being a little bit less efficient, and you can actually lose information. But we're really interested in energies that are on the order of 1,000 times or even 1,000,000 times higher than our threshold energy. Mm-hmm. So for anything that we're interested in, we're going to see it.
We're going to see it. Thanks, John, for calling. Gay and Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Gay.
Yeah, my question's a lot easier, I think. It sounds like you have a great project here, insofar as I can understand it. But I'm wondering if there are any implications for the study of global warming in your research.
We'll turn to Bob Polis. All right. First, Cale. We'll go to you first, Cale. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I can't think of anything at the moment, maybe hand it over to Bob.
All right, Bob, what do you think?
Okay, well, the short answer is not directly. However, I will say that because of the type of drilling technology that we're involved in and promoting sort of the advancement of that technology, that we will certain and that there is some benefit to the general community that studies, say, ice climatology down in that region. So indirectly, I would say we certainly support that sort of effort. And from time to time interact with people who are working on climatological studies down at Pole and in Antarctica generally.
Hmm. Thanks, Gay, for calling. And Jeff, we'll give you a chance. If you'd like to join in, still some open lines here for you at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Jeff, we turn to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I've got about a dozen questions here. This is so interesting. I keep writing down more and more. I actually called in just to ask about the movement of the ice there. Is it going to distort things over time? But I have an even better question than that, so you can hit that. But I remember a couple of years ago when Fermilab shot a bunch of neutrinos right under our feet here in Madison to the detector up in northern Minnesota, and it was one of the ways that they were discovering that neutrinos do have mass. It sounds like we could do the same thing on a bigger scale and have a real known neutrino source to shoot at your detector and could find out even more. That's two of mine on my list.
Okay. Well, let's go turn to Cale Hansen first. Cale?
Yeah, so you were talking about the Minos experiment at Fermilab. You're right. I mean, that's actually that is possible to do kind of the analog. You could actually take a conventional high energy accelerator and shoot it at the South Pole. I mean, certainly we've got quite a large detector. I believe there are probably some issues there. As I said before, we're basically tuned for much, much higher energies. So, I haven't done the calculations, but I would guess that we would probably, at the energies of a neutrino beam, at least from something like Fermilab, it's probably a little bit too low for us. However, we can, so actually in on one of the past experiments that I worked on, which was more or less the same thing, looking at cosmic ray neutrinos at a smaller detector in Italy, you can actually use, there's another beam that's not of terrestrial origin, or at least not of man-made terrestrial origin, and but it's actually a known beam, a fairly well-known beam. And that's what's called atmospheric neutrinos. So the Earth is constantly being bombarded by cosmic rays, and these cosmic rays, when they interact in the atmosphere in the atmosphere above the North Pole, or at least above the Northern Hemisphere for us, on the other side of the Earth, we can use that the resulting neutrinos that come from these interactions. These neutrinos will travel through the Earth, and they actually can transit, can oscillate, what's called oscillate, where they actually change their flavor as they're going through the Earth, and that's another possible means by which we can estimate neutrino mass.
And I'm wondering, Bob Paulus, our caller Jeff mentioned ice movement and what effect that might have.
So he's absolutely right. The caller is absolutely right. The ice sheet is, in fact, moving. It moves about 10 meters a year or so. And we know that. And the biggest problem is the worry about what the effect might be on differential movement in the ice sheet. So we know that most of that differential movement occurs in about the lower half a kilometer of the South Pole Glacier, and so we avoid that. So we drill down 2,500 meters, and most of the motion occurs in that bottom 500 meters.
Okay.
So we don't want to get too close to bedrock, otherwise what would happen is our cables would get stretched and sheared. So we did think of that, but that's a good question.
Jeff, thank you. appreciate the call very much. Well, Cale, are you staying in? You're not staying in a tent down there, are you?
No, this is my first time. So this is actually my fourth trip down here. This is my first time in staying in the very, I would say, well-equipped new station that has been under construction here for the past couple of years. There are a couple of different scales or grades of accommodation you can have when you're staying here. And in my first couple of years, I was in the more rough,
austere,
and crude accommodations. The austere, yes, exactly, accommodations that were somewhat maybe located a couple hundred meters away from the station in a field commonly somewhat whimsically termed a summer camp. And there you are actually, you're in, I would say it's not exactly a tent, but it's not much more. It's called a Janesway. It's, more or less a half cylinder, that, they just plop on the ice and cover with, some sort of insulating material. But they're getting kind of old now, and some of them are a little bit leaky. So, it's not always, it's kind of a mixed bag.
But the new digs are a lot better.
Oh, yes. Honestly, for sitting where I am right now, I could almost convince myself that I'm, you know, anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, in the, you know, just in an office building somewhere. It's very, very open space. There's plenty of light. It's quite nice. I like it quite a bit.
Well, and Bob Paulus, 20 collaborators working with the University of Wisconsin. That's a fantastic number of collaborators.
Yeah,
collaborators.
Actually, the number it continues to creep up, and we're now nearing 30 collaborating institutions. About half of those are in the U.S., and the other half are non-U.S., principally in Europe. Although we also have a collaborator in Japan, for instance. So yes, so how this is. People might be curious, so how what that means and how that gets funded. Our European collaborators are self-funded, so they provide money to the project to support their own people. And the National Science Foundation provides support directly to all of the U.S. institutions. That money is funneled through UW-Madison, and then we distribute it to our collaborators based on every year's project plan and so on and so forth. So about $240 million will clear the books here in Madison.
Well, it's an interesting project, to say the least. And Cale, good luck down there. I hope you have some.
Thank you, Larry.
I hope you have some lotion for your hands for the dryness. Thanks. Well, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with you again. Thanks again for being with us. Bob Paulus, thank you so much. You've been there many times. Just got back in from December, I believe,
right before the holidays, yes.
Right before the holidays. So pleasure to have you with us, too, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I'd love to hear how things are going down there and what you're finding.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot, Larry.
Thank you both very much. Bob Paulus is a UW-Madison engineer, project manager of Ice Cube near the South Pole. And our second guest, who is at the South Pole, Cale Hansen, an Ice Cube scientist, connected with the University of Wisconsin, obviously, as well. Kind of proud to have a research effort of this magnitude conceived and led by University of Wisconsin scientists. And we'll hear some more. We'll get an update from time to time and see how things are going with them. And we're going to sort of stay with the weather and climate, at least, issues. Somebody raised a question about climate earlier on here. And we'll talk climate and weather with our weather guys coming up next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.